Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. I'm going to start this week with a comment from last week. Now, bear with me. It will make sense. Okay, Steve Marson says, and he was talking about when we were having a conversation last week about YouTube photography videos. He said, I'm afraid 95% of YouTube photography videos really just have mild entertainment value. All the gear reviews and seven wave videos are usually because they haven't got any original content that week. Anyway, it goes on a bit more, you know, no offence, Steve, is a bit of a, you know, a lot. Anyway, so get to the end, and he says, but usually, hang on a second, a 20-minute meander with someone who has a bit of character and outtaking images is often an entertaining and informative, but usually because of discussing their thought processes and assessment of compositions. Adam Gibbs is a classic case in point. Ugh, all the rest are mostly waffle and self-promotion.
I agree.
That's what I mean.
Totally agree with that.
So, funnily enough, look who's on tonight. We've got Adam Gibbs with us. So, all your prayers have been answered, Steve. So, welcome, Adam. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I know you invited me because I don't waffle on like everybody else.
That's exactly why. I mean, literally, we read that from Steve and went, oh, Adam, completely forgotten about him.
When I'm doing the videos, and I'm sure you guys feel the same way, you always feel like you're waffling on, you know, you go, oh, God. And then you start repeating yourself, you know, two or three times, saying the same thing throughout the video, you know. But
yeah.
Well, thank you for that comment.
I was reading somewhere on, I think it was on one of the Facebook groups I'm on, that someone recorded their first YouTube vlog this week. And I think they said they had 109 minutes of them talking.
I read that.
And they've managed to cut it down to about 37.
30, yeah. Which is still too long as well, isn't it? Three parts out of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, actually, I know we've not discussed this, but what we might have touched this in the past, actually, but what would you reckon is the perfect length of video? Now, I know that's a little.
I'm glad you can't
sure
see
can all
that.
Comment on that. That's rather personal.
I thought Malib returned for a minute.
My mum told me we haven't been dirty enough lately. So
there we go. Is that right?
Okay. 5 minutes in. About 10 to 15 minutes usually, isn't it? Is what I'd say.
Yeah.
15 minutes.
Anything over that, it's got to be quite a special vlogger for me, for me to hold my attention for 20 to 25 minutes. There's not many out there that I see a 25-minute video and I think, oh, I definitely want to watch that. If it's 10 to 15, I'm generally happy with that.
Do you agree with that? Yeah, it's not often you look at it and think, oh, good, 25 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, your heart doesn't leap and you think, terrific.
Yeah. I must admit, Tom's, it makes no difference to me what length of videos Tom puts out. I generally watch, even if they're 20, 25 minutes. But, there's not...
Well, they are about 20 minutes, aren't they, usually, I think, Tom's. Don't they say that the longer they are, the more view time it's going to get? YouTube going to push it.
And I think that's one of the reasons why people do longer videos, is because even though they might only be watching 50% of your video... Obviously, if it's a 20-minute video, then they're going to be watching 10 minutes. If it's only a 10-minute video, they're only going to be watching 5 minutes. So even though most people don't watch the whole video...
Your average viewing time is going to increase anyway, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's funny because that comment that Gary just said about... I mean, because I sometimes I think, like, oh, my videos are just going on and on and on. And I'm waffling and then I end up splitting them into like four or five videos and then... slowly the viewership goes off because people are just getting bored of me talking about the same area over and over again, you know.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think you're doing all right.
Well, it's funny, you know, because lately I was getting a bit tired of doing the video. I don't know if many people noticed, but I was putting in less and less B-roll and drone footage and just plonking the camera down and talking in front of the camera, because what I was finding is I was watching other people's videos and they're all the same. You know, you got the walk by and then you got the pulling the camera out of the bag and then, you know, the usual, all the same stuff. And I thought, well, why bother doing any of that stuff? Just start, get right into the meat and potatoes and just talk about what you're... But I think people like to kind of see, you know, where you are, the environment, and get a kind of a sense of where the place is. So I the last couple of videos, I thought, maybe I better put a bit more effort into them again and actually take some video. You know,
there's definitely a formula that a lot of people go by, and it's like you say, it's sort of, and I find myself doing it, and that's when I kind of get bored and want to do something new, is when you find yourself going, right, turn up, film a bit of B-roll, and then, I must record myself walking the first bit, and then slow motion that down in the edit, and then get there and talk for a bit, show a photo, a bit more B-roll, a bit more talking, a bit another photo. And it's like, it's almost like painting by numbers, you know, but it's...
To be fair, mate, the first time we went out, I was amazed how fast you walk in real life.
I quite like the B-roll, though. I do. I like to see where people are. I know, like, walking past the camera is one thing, but I think if you just showed a track, it wouldn't look as good as if there was a person in it. And as you're the only one out there, you have to be the, you know, the prop, if you like. But I enjoy that.
I think if you look at your analytics, if anybody ever can be bothered to do that, you'll see that sometimes if you start talking about whether you're in, you know, talking about composition or whatever you're talking about, you get a bit of a peak at the beginning, and then the longer you talk, it just tails off because people are starting getting bored with you, and then all of a sudden you'll show a shot or your B-roll changes, and then it'll peak up again. So I think that shows that, you know,
that's people
you do...
stopping it and rewinding it, pausing it and reviewing it.
Yeah, possibly. There's always a peak where the images are because people just stop it. Maybe they just stop it and want to look at the image for a bit longer than you show it for.
We all have different styles, but I find it really important to showcase where you are, the location,
be
as possible. Definitely.
I think, I mean, there are some of the more popular videos you see on YouTube, right? People don't say anything. You know, some of the hiking ones I watch, and they're really interesting. There's a guy named Craig Adams I watch now and then, and it's just him hiking. And I thought, this is going to be boring. But, you know, after 20 minutes, I'm still watching it. I thought, this is really interesting. So
there's some nice music. Yeah,
that's visual storytelling, though, isn't it? That's all about visual storytelling.
Well, actually, the guy was quite interesting because he used to do wedding photography videos. And I guess he wasn't getting much traction. So he just deleted all of his videos and just started from scratch. And he started doing hiking videos. And he doesn't even use that much music. It's just all the ambient sounds of where he is. And it's, I find it fascinating. Yeah. I've often thought of doing something like that, but I don't know how well it would go over, you know. I know Tom's done a couple, and Nick has done one or two as well, I think.
Yeah, so I was going to say, I know Nick's done a couple. He did an excellent one with the storm,
which was literally
all just, and that was brilliant. And I know Ian Worth over here has done a few as well, and they're very good, so...
If you've got the conditions, i.e. the wind, the crunching snow on foot, then obviously that helps. You've got the natural ambience around you anyway.
Yeah. Because let's face it, I mean, there's only so much you can say about photography. After a while, it gets very samey.
Yeah.
I remember in the garden industry, it was very much like that. The magazines would come out, and it was always the same stuff, just said in a slightly different way. And photography is very similar. I mean, how many different ways can you just tell people... you know, talk about one subject. So it boils down to kind of your character, or if you can say it in a more engaging way, I guess. I'm not sure.
Absolutely. I think it's the stories. I genuinely do often think it's the stories you tell and if people engage with those stories. And when I was saying about the doing it by numbers, I wasn't referring necessarily to other people's perception of it, but I get bored with doing it myself. I get kind of bored with that style, and then every now and again I want to change it up and do something slightly different, you know.
Yeah, well, you have to keep it interesting for yourself, don't you? Otherwise it's going to come across as you're bored.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, here we go again.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, just chuck in a boot review every now and then.
That's right. A rubber boot.
What's in your bag?
I mean, that was slightly left field. That said, I rushed out and bought a pair, and they're brilliant.
So did I.
A lot of people did, I think.
Yeah. So I've got some.
You need to have a word with them and get some, get a piece of the action.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you guys are the same. People send you stuff. Companies, they want you to promote their stuff, and some of it's just crap, and then other stuff is, you think, oh, I mean, might be kind of cool, you know. Recently there was a company sent me a vest, but it has a battery pack in it, and it heats up, I thought, oh, that's kind of gimmicky, you know. But I went out and I tried it. Brilliant, you know. Yeah. I was a bit chilly, so I turned the thing on and, ooh, that feels good, you know.
Toasty.
So I thought, well, yeah, they want me to do a review of that. Yeah, I'll throw in a review.
Did they do one with pants?
I think, I'm not sure.
Jock straps.
My pants are on fire.
Just remember, if you've got it on, though, and it gets too hot, don't throw yourself in the nearest lake.
Yeah,
that would be a good idea. Just take it off.
Yeah.
Toss in the back.
Yeah. So we were going to talk about this week. Actually, we were going to talk about a new competition online that you're a judge in, Adam. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Natural Landscape Photography Awards. And it's something I think that's being run by Alex Nail. And the reason that it drew my attention was on the website, you've got this sort of list of things that it sort of won't allow, like the rules. And I couldn't believe that some of those things were even allowed in the first place. In other competitions, I was absolutely shocked. So, you know, I mean, I don't know, do you want to go through what your feelings on it?
Well, I have to look at their names here, because there's four people that I believe started the contest. So there's Alex Nail, Matt Payne, Rajesh, now I can't pronounce his surname, so I'm not going to even try, and Tim Parkin. And it was actually my friend Alistair Ben, he asked me if I wanted to be a part of this contest. So I had a chat with Tim on Zoom, and I didn't realize, but Tim is actually one of the judges for the Wildlife Photographer of the Year. He's been a judge for 20 years, I think, or maybe longer, I don't know. And as most of you know, the Wildlife Photographer of the Year has been going for 50, 60 years, and they have pretty stringent rules about digital photography, because they really want to make it so that wildlife comes first. And not so much the photography, even though it's a photo contest. And I think what's kind of happened over the years, like the International Landscape Photographer of the Year, the Epson Pano Awards and so on, it's got to the point now where it's not really the photography, it's more digital art, and there aren't any rules. You can pretty much do whatever you want. And to be honest with you, I mean, Tim was one of the judges for the International Landscape Photographer of the Year this past year. And this is going to sound like sour grapes, because I entered again. I didn't get anywhere in it. But I was really disappointed with the winners, because I just thought that they were just so digitally manipulated. And I don't necessarily have a problem with images that are manipulated, but we're kind of veering away from the art of actually photography. There is definitely an art in not just the final image, but actually taking the image. And with digital AI software and so on, we're really starting to depart away from the art of photography. And I think that's where this contest has stemmed from. Of course, it's still, everything's new. We will see how it goes with applying specific rules and so on. I'm not sure how it's going to all turn out, because obviously there is going to be some kind of digital manipulation or work, especially if you're shooting raw files. I mean, you have to. So it's coming up with the rules that aren't so stuck up or stuffy, that it's going to look kind of pompous. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean,
what's the difference between this competition and, say, the classic view in Landscape Photographer of the Year?
Well, I don't know that one. Classic view.
Well, I think in the Landscape Photographer of the Year, you've got several categories. And the classic view...
Oh, is that that's the English? That's
the English one. Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Yeah. Essentially, in the classic view, you can't touch anything. I think it's really similar. I'm just reading the website for this new one that you're judging in. It says the permitted adjustments digitally are creating panos, exposure bracketing, improving the technical quality of the image, i.e. image stacking, averaging, and focus stacking, removing lens flare and removing dust spots. And I'm pretty sure that covers the classic view in the UK landscape photographer of the year.
I think one of the other issues, and I mean, this is a personal thing. For me, when it comes to nature photography, nature has always come first. Photography is kind of an extension of my enjoyment of nature. Whereas if you look at a lot of images on Instagram or any of the social media, it's all about the image, and the actual subject more or less takes kind of a back seat. And I think the problem that's coming about this, that I see anyway, is that because the public is becoming more and more detached from wilderness areas, nature, as soon as you start posting images of these fantasized views of nature that have been so manipulated, nobody knows what's real anymore. And, the last few weeks, I've been spending a lot of time on the West Coast. There's a lot of old growth logging going on. And I've tried to photograph it in such a way that it represents the area reasonably true to form. But if I manipulated the hell out of it to the point where it's some fantasy view of the world, I think a lot of people are missing the point. And I think at the end of the day, I think we're going to have a real danger of people thinking, well, everything's fine in the backwoods because look at this photograph. It just shows this beautiful view of nature, when in fact, it's not like that at all. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons why they started up this contest, kind of like the Wildlife Photographer of the Year. It's the same thing. And that's why they're very strict about looking into the winners. And I mean, in the past, there's been a few kerfuffles with people cheating. Tim was telling me about some of the, I couldn't believe the things people do to try and win a contest. It's just unbelievable.
Well, I'm looking on here at some of these things that they're saying are not in the rules, you know, are not allowed. And I'm just gobsmacked that people even do that before they enter a competition. So like, there's one here that's distorting existing elements, and it's like literally taking an image with some mountains in the background and then puppet warping the mountains to make them look bigger. And I'm surprised that even happens.
A lot of people do that. I mean, that's what I'm saying. If you don't go out into nature that often, how would you know? I mean, you'll see a picture of this epic peak. It's funny because someone posted a photo of a mountain not far from Vancouver called Mount Cham, and I knew it well because I've climbed it. And I'm looking at the picture and I went, hang on a minute, I know that mountain. That's Mount Cham. And it was like this. And in reality, it's like this, you know. So they just like...
It's crazy.
Are we talking like composites as well, then, where they're bringing parts or selections of other areas into the same image?
Well, I think up until this point, I'm not sure how much composites people do in contests. I know in the International Landscape Photographer of the Year, the winner the year before was a fellow named Max Rive. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to take... I mean, Max Rive is a brilliant photographer, but he has a lot of really epic scenes with people, you know, a little figure standing there, and there's these beams of light coming through, and you go, oh my God, that's just incredible. Mm. But then you start to wonder, well, how much of that was actually there, and how much has he added in there, you know? Mm. And then I found out that he was a big proponent of one of these... a software where you can actually add beams of light, you know.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, well, did he add those beams of light, or did he actually, was he actually there? Do you know, you start to question, well, how much of that is legitimate and how much is just done in Photoshop?
Yeah.
And then you think, well, is it really a photograph? And I'm actually thinking of doing a video at some point if I get round to it. I'm just going to buy or lease a whole bunch of images from a stock agency, epic images, and just combine them all into one and see what kind of job I can do on that, and just say, well, here's my photograph.
That's brilliant. You know?
I mean, how is that any different?
I think the thing as well is that if people start doing that too much, and they probably are doing it already too much, it kind of takes, like, everyone who looks at that is going to question it the same as you are. They're going to go, are you a photographer? Is this photographer actually, is he actually a skilled photographer, or is he just a skilled post-processor?
There's so many times on social media that I've seen what looks to be like a really great photo, and then before I go to like it or comment, I kind of just hold back and I just think, is that photo actually real? You know, and it's a shame because you do start to question it a lot more now. Well, I know I certainly do anyway.
And I think the other thing is, unfortunately, social media is one of those things where people are always after the numbers. You know, they're after the likes and they want to legitimize their photography for whatever reason. I'm not really sure. Unless you're doing it professionally, then who cares? I mean, really, why would you care how many thumbs up you get? I mean, I don't get it. But, you know, the images have to be more and more epic because you're trying to outdo someone else with the epicness, you know.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a photograph that's been, someone's spent a lot of time in the field waiting for the light. And, of course, they're not going to get an image that epic because it just doesn't exist. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
It's whether the recognition that we're looking for is being a photographer or being a creative artist. And if you declare that you're a photographer and you want recognition for being a photographer, then you're judged on your photography, not on how well you can post process an image and how well you can make it impactful on social media. But there's a category for both, I guess, because creative artists is something that you can be judged on as well, how well you can do post-production and how well you can make things pop and impactful.
Well, there's a couple of photos that I've seen this week, which I did think had fantastic light. And one of them was posted yesterday from James Bellings. Because when I was driving home, obviously I'm driving north, and I could see that such a kind of dark, moody, angry sky. It was south of me and slightly to the west. So as I'm driving, I kept looking at my left-hand window and I just thought, oh, I'd like to be behind the camera now. Well, James obviously kind of, he went down to the river and he got a great shot. And the other one was Mr. Griff's.
Yeah, I saw that.
That was a fantastic shot that you got. Was it today, Dave, you took that, or was that yesterday?
Which one's that?
The one that you posted on Twitter.
No, that's an old one, isn't it?
Was that an old one?
A Ravel.
Black and white?
No. You posted it today.
You said you were going to do a bird video and you binned it off now.
That's from a vlog that I put out about last September time.
Oh, I thought that was from the local storms that
was
we've
been
having.
Was it about Luminol? No. Was that vlog about Luminol? Scar replacement?
That's the one. It was sunbeamsrus.com.
I was going to say, you could tell when he took it, because if it had a jetty in it, then it's a very small window in the last week or so. And if it doesn't have a jetty in it, then it's either after yesterday or...
Right, I'm out of here.
Come on, Dave. Come on, let's talk about your jetty. Come on. Yeah.
What happened, Dave? Come on, share. Share, come on.
Well, see, Jamie was there saying, oh, did you video it? No sympathy whatsoever. I just wanted to see it getting trashed by the storm.
I just thought we might as well make the most of the situation.
Yeah. No, the thing is, it kind of went overnight. I looked out through my telescope to see how it was doing just around about 6 o'clock at night as the storm was getting up. And then the next morning, looked down, oh, no, nothing there. Yeah. There used to be a jetty.
Where were the boats?
That, really? Well, one boat was up against a dry stone wall getting smashed to bits. And the other was just kind of scuffed and on the mud. Mm. So it was just, I don't know why, what I was thinking building it at this time of year. I should have waited and then left the boats well out of the water level because I normally bring them out over winter.
I could be wrong here, Dave, but I'm pretty sure that we all said to you on one of the last few podcasts, don't build it at this time of the year. It's an absolute
I remember saying,
there's a storm coming.
Adam messaged us. He messaged us and said, Dave's mad. Dave's mad if he's going to do that. So you were warned.
Even Mally said it. I mean, in fact, Mally's put something on the group. I don't know what he's put on here.
Some expletive, probably.
I know, do I?
Oh, here we are.
Well, hang on. I've got my...
Is it for sharing?
I don't know yet. I'm going to share it anyway.
Go on, share it anyway, and I'll edit it out if necessary.
Right, hang on a second. Let's
We're talking one. You got me running. I got me searching. Hold on. Sweet talking love. So sad. Then to wait over. Talking woman.
See, all even right. when he's not here, even when he's not here, he just posts random stuff.
He's clearly missing us, isn't he?
He's clearly missing us. Yeah.
Either that, he's or mental. Recording that for his new podcast, "How I Became a Pop Star." it's one of the two.
Crazy.
Sure.
Going back to the
conversation about digital art and all of that, I just wanted to say that I remember 4 or 5, maybe 6 years ago when I was. You know, I'm not saying I'm any good now, but when I was way worse than I am now, looking at stuff on 500 pics, and for me, 500 pics is the place for digital art. And I was looking at pictures of waterfalls, so I was thinking, oh, I'll go and do some waterfall photography, and I just thought, I'm never ever going to take that, never going to be able to do that. It's too good for me. I don't even know how he's got that light and that, you know, everything about it. And then you realise, well, as you become a better photographer, it's because it doesn't exist. It's all composite and manipulated and just made up. And it must be so soul-destroying for photographers who are starting out, who are not at a level to understand any better, thinking, I'm never, ever going to take that, ever going to take that. How's he even doing that, you know?
Well, I think that's... I don't know if you guys watch Alistair's YouTube channel, but that was one of the reasons why he started that channel, was to talk more about... like, sometimes he gets a bit too deep for me, but... talk about the actual, you know, the thought process behind taking images and why we do it and the whys and such. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm certainly not complaining to people say, well, you shouldn't manipulate your images. I mean, if that's what you enjoy doing, then go for it. But I do think at the end of the day, as a nature photographer, it does take away from our ability to actually see what's out there in the real natural world rather than a fantasy world. And that's what I worry about anyway. And, you know, I'm like some of you guys. I mean, I'm old school. I started photography with film and where, you know, you pretty much what you saw is what you got, and garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. Mm. But now you can take a relatively poor image and make it look actually quite good, whereas you couldn't do that before. And I don't know, it's just a personal thing. I mean,
I do that a lot.
Me too. Yeah, me too. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I, on my videos, I started showing the raw file and then the finished image, because I wanted people to see how much work I'd actually done on a photograph. Some of them I haven't done anything, and some I have done quite a bit, you know. I mean, I clone out stuff but I try to do as much in the field as I can before I bring it into Photoshop, because it's way easier to do it in the field than after the fact, that's for sure.
Mm. But even when you say you've done quite a bit, you know, in comparison to others, it's not a lot, really, looking at the stuff you've posted before. I think your post-processing is very minimal, really. You are doing the bare minimum to get that picture. You're certainly not creating something that wasn't there or turning the image into something that didn't represent what you saw.
Well, I think at the end of the day, it boils down to integrity, doesn't it? It boils down to trying to represent something that does exist rather than something that just exists in my head, you know. My brother sent me a post this morning. There's a piece of artwork that just sold, digital art, for $69 million. And it's just a composites of thousands of little images. And it seems to be the most popular thing right now. I think William Shatner put together a few little photographs from his acting days, and he had, I think he printed up 150,000 of them, and they sold out like that. Mm-hmm. He was selling them for $1 each.
Wow.
And this seems to be the new trend now, is these... I'll have to try and find the article. It's weird. It's all these... You know, you might get your full body of work that you've taken over the past 20 years and put them all in one photograph.
Perhaps we could do that with the podcast. All these little thumbnails here. If we go on for another couple of years...
Sell them for $1 each.
You'll make a collage of Mally out of it.
Better than a T-shirt.
when you step back and see the whole picture is just a giant arse.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there a program where it would actually do that? It would put all these, all your photographs together and actually make another image out of.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, yeah. I remember there was always a famous one, which was the Star Wars one, wasn't there? Which was the loads of pictures of, I think it was Anakin Skywalker, and then when you step back, it was Darth Vader.
Yeah, okay.
Or I might have dreamt that. I'm not sure. One of the two. But yeah, I was going to say, on the subject of competitions, and this is like something that is literally just popped up today that maybe we could talk about. I just need to search through it for a second. Neil Burnell. Do you know Neil Burnell?
Yes. Adam? Yes.
Yeah.
So actually, I have a print of Neil's here somewhere.
Yeah, he's.
Actually, it's quite interesting. I was going to mention this really quickly, actually.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go for it.
I've done this in the past. It's a great way to get prints from other photographers is to have a print exchange. I used to do it quite a bit with friends of mine. And what we'd do is, if we saw a print that we really liked of theirs, we'd say, well, I'll trade you a print of the same size for, you know, a print of yours.
That's
and
a good idea.
Neil contacted me the other day. He says, oh, do you want to do a print exchange? Because I bought his book. I said, yeah, I wouldn't mind a shot of Wispman's Woods. So we did a print exchange. But it's a great way to, so you're not spending hundreds of dollars.
I'll tell you what, then. I do this live. Adam, do you want to do a print exchange?
Sorry? Oh, my head.
Oh, what's going on? Going for a tunnel?
Yeah, you can watch. Now we're going to get thousands of people asking for print exchanges.
Yeah. I think you and Neil got similar sort of subject interest, though, weren't you? To be honest, as well.
Well, the problem with, the problem with prints.
Mossy trees.
Where do you put them? You know, I mean, I have all these prints of other people's. I mean, I am hoping to build a studio in the garden here at some point, and maybe I can put them up there. But anyway, yes.
Well, when you get round to that, you can switch one with Darren then, can't you? When you've got.
Yeah, all right.
Just make sure you reserve a space for Darren.
I want a picture of a little robin.
And get upset.
A little cute little robin. Because we don't get robins. We just have
I've not printed any of my wildlife photos, actually.
Get on it.
I don't print any of them.
There's a market there.
Yeah. And a badger. I wouldn't mind a picture of a badger. A cute badger.
Yeah. I'll try. But all I'm printing at the moment is actually Newnham College. That's everything that's I'm printing now is just of the college. So
I'm sure Adam can relate to that.
No, not at all.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, well, this is that's a you can't see that, can you? It's in a
yes, I saw that in one of the podcasts. Nice, it's a great shot, but I can't. No, I wouldn't hang on my wall because
no, that's going in the college. That one, that's why
you could put that underneath. You know, like you get like 5-star, like great film. You could put underneath great shot, but I wouldn't hang it on my wall.
Precisely,
average at best.
Oh, poor at best. Oh.
There's no excuse for blowing your highlights. So anyway, so basically, this is what Neil's put in his Instagram stories. And this is really interesting because this might lead to another bit of a conversation. He said, I was recently asked to help judge a photography competition, but I've declined after doing some research into the comp. He said, this particular comp was accused of being a cash grab with one main beneficiary. With so many comps out there today, it seems the market is now oversaturated. New competitions seem to pop up all the time now and becoming more expensive with less prizes. And he said, I'm all for free or charity comps, and there's certainly a place for long-standing prestigious competitions. And then I think he asks about getting people's thoughts. But it's interesting because I was thinking about this. There are a lot of competitions about at the moment. And when you enter a competition, how many of us actually read the T's and C's? Because I entered, it's a small competition, but the Beds Cams and North Hants Wildlife Trust competition. And I got two images in their calendar last year, and I didn't get anything for it. I didn't win. I didn't come in the top three, so I didn't win any of the prizes. No one else got two in, and I did. And they're using one of mine all the time for all of their promo material. And I've got nothing as a photographer. I know when I entered it, I knew the rules, but I've got nothing as a photographer. Do you think a lot of competitions then, like probably not don't have the integrity of the one you're doing, Adam, which is more about capturing real places or the real nature of somewhere. And a lot of them are just literally to get money off of you or to get images that they can use to promote their own, you know, for their own ends.
For sure. I mean, well, even the one I'm doing, I mean, it's to make money. I mean, they're definitely to make money. It's no secret. And, why am I on YouTube? Well, ultimately to make money. I mean, that's my business. And I don't apologize for that. But you do have to be really careful with a lot of contests, because in the rules they'll put things like where they can use the images for anything, or, and some of these might be ad agencies, or, and they're just trying to get freebies. And let's face it, I mean, there's an awful lot of amateurs out there that are just as good, if not better, than pros, and they're sending off their stuff just for recognition. Don't do it, you know. I get these requests all the time, or I used to, not so much anymore. People would say, oh, we'd love to use one of your images, but we can't pay you, but we'll give you a credit line. I don't need a credit line. I don't, you know, because nobody reads the credit lines. The only people that read credit lines are other photographers. Yeah. I just don't do it. Read the rules. And contests are expensive, some of them, but I think in some ways it's a good thing, because I got to tell you, I judged the International Landscape Photographer, was it last year or the year before? And I was sitting behind my computer for 3 days solid looking at images, thousands and thousands of images, and that's an expensive one. It's $25 per image. You imagine if it was $5 per image or free? I mean, people would just send all their crap. So I think what it does, it makes people think about, well, you know, think a bit harder about what they're going to send to the contest. Sometimes less is more, you know. I don't know what else to say. You have to really read the rules, though.
Definitely.
Generally, I mean, if I'm going to enter a contest, I'll enter something that's been around for a while and has a bit of, like, the Wildlife Photographer of the Year. I think it's a brilliant contest. It used to be free when I first started sending to them, but now they charge because it's just getting expensive to, you know, they have to pay the judges, because who wants to sit behind a computer for free for weeks?
So other than Adam, then, has everybody here put their photos in?
Nearly. I've submitted three so far.
When is the closing date?
Is it 21st of April or end of April?
It's still quite a while to go.
What's that for?
The Landscape Photographer of the Year.
Oh, the English one, yeah.
UK, yeah. But you're right, Adam. You've got to be really selective, aren't you? I mean, it's £25 for 8 images.
It
adds up. And you're right. You've got to put a little bit of thought into it. But yeah. they've opened the window. I think you can go back to, is it 5 years?
Yeah. I mean, contests aren't for everybody. It's kind of a weird thing because photography isn't, or landscape photography isn't generally, we don't go out there to compete against other people. And then all of a sudden you're entering this contest. But, you know, for me, as doing it for a living, I mean, it validates my photography. I mean, it really does help. You know, when I won the International Landscape Photographer of the Year, I mean, I couldn't believe I won, for first of all. And then secondly, it validated my, not that I needed validation, but it just gives you the extra bit of, you know.
What year did you win, Adam?
2018.
Just have a little bit behind you.
I think going on the point of competitions, because landscape photography is such a saturated market, there's thousands and thousands, and in a way competitions are people's chance to get praise. In a way, you might as well throw in some of your favorite images for the chance that they are selected.
I've done really well in contests. I used to enter a lot when I first started. I entered the Wildlife Photographer of the Year quite a few times, and I'm not even a wildlife photographer, but they had other categories, landscape and so on, and I'd enter those, and I did all right. One year I got a runner-up, I believe, and they actually flew me out to London. And actually, that was another reason why Tim and Alex and those guys started up this landscape photography contest is because the Wildlife Photographer of the Year, they've eliminated the landscape category in that contest. So there's no contests out there that have the similar rules to the Wildlife Photographer of the Year. So that's why they kind of started it up. I forgot about that.
Okay.
Because they wanted something where, you know, you can send images where they're not manipulated to death, you know.
I kind of look at me entering a landscape photography competition like throwing my best eight chat-up lines at Miss World.
It's worth a go, but you're not going to get very far.
No, you're probably going to get a kick in the balls.
You're not going to get highly commended anywhere. But you might come first.
You might. And
there's a very good chance of that.
Well, there is. When I first started in photography back in the 90s, I took a photograph behind my house and I just lucked out with the light. Just lucked out. And I sent it off to a contest. It was in a magazine called Photo Digest, which is now defunct. But I won the grand prize. I won a Hasselblad.
Wow.
Wow.
Couldn't believe it. Won a Hasselblad. You know, $5,000-$6,000 Hasselblad and a lens. And wow. I ended up selling it because I needed the money. But and that was just a one-off image that...
Did you sell it to Tom?
Yeah.
Just before a newer Hasselblad came out.
Yeah. Yeah, so I saw that the GFX 100 was coming out. I thought, I'm going to get rid of my camera quick before, you know. So I sold it to Tom, and then they announced the GFX 100S. And he's like, what the hell?
Just out of interest, Anna, how much did that winning that influence the rest of your photography career? Did it really give you that boost to say, actually, I'm probably pretty good at this, and I can get out and do more of this? And
well, it was funny because that photograph, and I talk about that photograph quite a bit, and when I do my talks and such, the light in it, at the time, it was just pure luck. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. After I'd won it, I really studied the photograph. I thought, okay, well, what does this have that my other photographs don't have? And from there, I started trying to implement exactly the same things that appealed to me in that photograph to all my other images. And it started to work. And then I started looking at a lot of other photographers' work in books and such, and I still do. And I tried to figure out, okay, what is it that I really like about this shot and what is it that I don't like? And then just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And then next time you're out in the field, you think, oh, yeah, there was a shot by Larry Ulrich that I really love. And this is kind of a similar situation. How can I kind of use some of those ideas in my own? And it's worked for me. I get a huge amount of inspiration from other photographers. And I still buy, lately I've been buying an awful lot of books. Just can't get enough, you know. I love books way more than looking at images online, for sure.
Have you got that image, by the way, Adam? Can you show that image?
Yeah, I'll have to...
dig it out.
It's just a photograph of trees, but the light was just absolutely stunning. There was evening light coming through the back. And, I don't know. I've always liked the photograph. It's quite dramatic, you know.
I think when we talked about Landscape Photography of the Year Award on previous podcasts, I think this is one of the reasons we said that we wanted to enter was to get that sort of benchmark, to get that acceptance. So if you got a highly commended or somebody actually recognised the image for what it was, it says, actually, okay, that's good. So I've reached a level now where my picture is being judged by experienced people, and therefore there's something in that image there that works, and I can learn from that, and I can develop on, you know, my photography from getting that benchmark right. And I think that for a lot of amateur photographers, it's just getting that initial step on the ladder to say, right, I've reached stage one, now I've got many more steps to go, but at least I know where I'm going.
I mean, it is very subjective, obviously, and you know, we all see the final images that have won and we go, oh, my images were better than that, you know. And but you really have to be honest with yourself when you're entering a contest. Look at your images and look at past winners and go, is my image as good as that winner? And you have to be really honest with yourself. Mm. Like, there's no thinking, well, you know, it's not quite as good, but they'll get past that. It doesn't work that way. When I was judging for this contest, it was quite an eye opener. because there were thousands of really great images, but now and then there would be one and it was just like, wow, that is amazing. And even though it's subjective, the final winners, there was, I think there was five judges, the ones that I thought were amazing, universally they ended up being the winners. Mm. They just stood out. There was something different about them. They weren't the same old views that everybody photographs. You know, so if you think that your photography, when you look at it, you go, is this something really, has this got like that wow factor or something really unique about it, then yeah, enter.
Mm. Okay. So moving on, anyway, moving on and talking about iconic images as we were, let's talk about some other iconic images. Now, this was Darren's idea. So, Darren, do you want to elaborate on what we're doing here?
Oh, no.
Well,
you ready for that, Darren?
Yes, yeah, sorry. It was just... No, how do you elaborate on that? Yeah. Should we just show the images? Yeah.
What we're doing is we're going to pick an iconic image from history that stuck in our mind, that someone else has taken, not necessarily one of our own.
You delivered that beautifully. Yeah,
that's why Gary runs the show. Yeah. And you
exactly.
Don't
exactly. So off just you go, wake Darren. Me up when it's time to talk.
You just come up with the shit ideas when you're on the bog. And
there
like,
you go.
Gary delivers them eloquently.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you start, Darren? Why don't you share with us your image?
Okay. Can you see that?
Oh, that's El Capitan, isn't it?
No.
Pablo Escobar, isn't it?
Pablo Escobar.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you what, I mean, I think me and James, or probably you guys are probably the same, but I know me and James have spoke about this in the past, that we do like a good kind of real life crime story. And I've watched a few documentaries on Pablo Escobar, and he was like, you know, just one evil, you know, so-and-so. But when I look at this particular photo here, this mugshot, it's a little bit like, you know, like they say, like the Mona Lisa. And it, is she smiling? Isn't she smiling? And you look at it and you can interpret things in a different way. And when I look at this particular photo, I look at him as if like, I don't know if he's smiling because he just doesn't care that he's going to prison. Or that smile is... I really don't care because when I get out, I'm going to murder you. Mm. Do you know, there's like an evil... I can't work that out. I can't work out if he's just doesn't care or there's real evil in this photo.
You see, he's psychopathic, isn't he? It's either that or he's really high on coke.
It's an incredibly menacing smile, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
You see it in his eyes. His mouth's smiling, but his eyes are telling you the real story.
Exactly. Yeah, that's when I do look at this. I think, yeah, that is quite an evil looking photo.
I just wish it was in colour so we could enjoy his shirt more. Really.
But that would be distracting.
It's good to share his telephone number though, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my kind of iconic. That's my go-to iconic shot.
Okay. I don't think I've ever seen that shot actually.
Have you not?
No.
Jamie. Because I know you had one in mind right from the beginning, didn't you? Right from the off, you thought, I know one.
Talking complete rubbish, Gary, and you know you are. I haven't got a bloody clue. But I have come up with something.
Is it one you thought of in your mind, you just haven't delivered it?
It was the one I thought of from the very beginning, yeah. It might be a slight surprise, but this is a iconic image. Formula One.
Yep.
So I quite like Formula One, as I think Dave does as well.
I know this one.
Avid watcher most weekends. And yeah, I chose this one. And this is the 1994 German Grand Prix, Hockenheim. And this is the Benetton crew. And Schumacher was the other driver. So you've got Jos Verstappen, who was the one that was in this melee of fire. And Schumacher was the other driver, and Schumacher had already been in and had a pretty normal pit stop. And then Jos Verstappen came in, and all of a sudden, I think he said he felt what he thought was water that was then clearly fuel, and their whole place just erupted when the fuel hit the engine, and this place just went up in flames. And the guy that took this shot, so the guy in this shot is a guy called Paul Seabee, who's the fuel guy. But the photographer is a guy called Stephen T, who was obviously employed by Motorsport. But he was obviously in the right place at the right time to get this image. But this is 1994, and obviously he was shooting on film at the time. So he hadn't got a clue what he'd got until he threw them into, you know, the sports desk, and then Monday they went through them, and he said he found loads of images all blurred, and then he found this one. And because obviously when it went out live, there was TV footage of this, and the images that were being shared were TV stills, effectively. And then when he saw this one, it just totally depicted the drama of the scene. Mm. And it was one that clearly then went on to, you know, field lots of debate about health and safety. And clearly, you know, modern day Formula One has no refueling, because this type of drama clearly is what can happen if things go wrong. So I think it was interesting that you've got a photographer that's actually, you know, created a scene or captured a scene that is normally this day and age captured by TV stills, like the Romain Grosjean crash last year. You know, most of the images you see are all TV stills rather than photographer images. So, yeah, I thought it was iconic on the basis that it was taken at a point in time when fueling was par for the course. But you can just see the drama that was, you know, this guy only actually came out with minor burns, as did Jos Verstappen. But yeah, it's just such a dramatic image.
It's a great photo.
I do remember that. I remember watching that, and I'm not a big motorsport fan. That didn't last for very long either. They put that out very quickly.
No, they put it out quite quickly. Yeah. So, well, the race carried on. Yeah, Gerhard Berger won the race. So, you know, it was only eight finished in this race. But after this happened, it was just business as usual. But I think, when you've got a fireball scene like this in the pits, it clearly creates. But the guy was clearly in the right place at the right time. And I bet he was chuffed to bits when he got these back and saw he'd got this one, sharp focus.
Mm.
It's a good job, really. They're in the pit lane, really, because fire extinguishers are so available. As opposed to on the race course.
If that had been in like a BP station or something where we just popped in to refuel, could have been carnage.
His pasty would have been warm.
They'd probably get a Ginsters.
So that's me.
Go on then, Dave. You can go next. What have you got, mate?
Oh, me? Okay. Share screen. Getting used to this now. No trouble at all. We'll start with this one. Okay, actually, we're going to see an image by a French contemporary of Henri Cartier-Bresson. But this is the one he's best known for, a guy called Robert Doisneau. They both sort of pioneered the photojournalism genre of the early to mid-20th century. And he was well known for this. This is the one that made his name, and it was in Life magazine. But the image that I chose from this photographer is this one. I bought a print of this in about 1983, and I still have it to this day on my bedroom wall, along with another print from a contemporary of theirs who's a bit younger, but Marc Ribot, a guy painting the Eiffel Tower. But this one, The Last Waltz of the 14th of July, I've always loved it, taken in 1949. And for me, given the constraints of the lighting conditions, the fact that it was a one-shot opportunity, it could very easily have blown the highlights. Everything about it technically, I think, is brilliant. But the mood that it conveys, I've just loved it for the last, 35, 40 years. I know that James is going to say the sign in the top right corner needs cropping out, but James is a Philistine. That's my sort of, if we have to talk about what might be considered iconic, but I mean, iconic is a debate in itself. But actually, if pressed, I would come back to my first love, which is landscapes. And the landscapes that I got into, kind of like what Adam was saying earlier, in books, when I started in 1979, 1980, I learned about landscape photography by going to the local library and saying, have you got a book on landscape photography? Oh, we've got this one here. And literally one book. And of course, it was Ansel Adams. And this is the classic half dome in Yosemite Valley. Every landscape photographer is probably aware of its existence, whether or not they know much about it. But I learned two lessons from this back in the early 80s that I've carried with me. And I'm now going to contradict what Adam was saying about photography. It should be representing what you're seeing, because one of the lessons I took from this, from Ansel going out and putting a red filter on his camera to turn the sky as black as he could, and then subsequently blackening it even further in post, he was exercising his creativity. And so going all the way back there, 1927, you know, for me as a young lad just getting into photography, that taught me that it didn't have to be what came out of the camera, that you could play with it a little bit. The other lesson I took from this in particular was that you have to get out there and get into position. At this point in time, all the photographs of Yosemite and all the iconic landscape locations, they were taken from accessible places. Now, Ansel Adams had a crew of people haul his gear halfway up the cliff face to get to this position to take this picture. And I think that's one of the things for me that makes it iconic, is that it really was something new and different. And it taught me that you've got to get out and get into position, which is, you know, what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, for example. But my actual favourite Ansel Adams image, which if I was pressed to say one iconic image that, you know, I would say from the waves on the desert island, is this one. And the lesson I took from this one, because Ansel Adams, this isn't his usual patch. He's down in New Mexico. He's heading home from a shoot and he sees the moon rise. But what he actually sees that makes him pull over and get his camera out, and he had one plate left, is the light catching the gravestones and the crucifixes in the graveyard. Okay. And he pulled over on the side of the road and got the shot. And the lesson I took from that as a young photographer is be capable of getting the shot, because you never know when that light is going to be there for 1 second and you've got one chance to get the shot. I mean, nowadays, of course, with digital, life is a lot easier because you can retake it and faff about. But what you can't do is say to the sun when it breaks through the clouds and chucks a nice sunbeam onto a mountain summit, hang on a minute while I faff about with my settings.
True.
And so for me, iconic photography comes back to my love of landscapes. And the reason it's iconic to me is because it's the lessons that I learned from it. And 40 years later, I still consider on a daily basis.
The cloud formations there as well are quite striking, aren't they? Unique.
I love the negative space. I mean, he's you know, half the image is just a slab of black. And I love that about it.
So, Adam, what have you got for us?
Well, it's funny that Dave was talking about Ansel Adams, because mine's an Ansel Adams shot as well.
Excellent.
And actually, it's funny. I guess it was about 15 years ago now. I was photographing some gardens up in north central British Columbia. And I got talking to the couple that I was photographing their garden. And it turned out that the guy that lived there was an American, and he was telling me that when he was a kid, he used to work for Ansel, and he used to load up the mules with all the photo gear up to the mountains. And of course, back then it was all glass plates, and it was quite interesting. This guy was going on about all these different trips you went on with Ansel, so I thought that was really interesting. Yeah,
you'd pay good money to have 10 minutes with somebody like that.
Yeah, and it was weird because they lived out in the middle of nowhere up in central British Columbia, you know. So, it was quite interesting. So my photograph is, now I don't want to balls up the name of this. I think this is called... oh God, what's it called now? winter storm clearing, I think, something like that. The reason why I picked this photograph was first of all, it was a brilliant photograph. But the first time I saw this photograph was on a climbing trip that I took down in Yosemite back in 1984. And it was 2 years before Ansel died. And back then I wasn't a photographer at all. And a friend and I had just climbed El Capitan, which is the big granite peak on the left side there. We'd climbed the regular route, it's called the Nose. And I actually celebrated my 19th birthday on the Nose. And then, funny enough, the next year I was in Yosemite and I celebrated my 20th birthday on Half Dome.
Ah.
So doing the regular north face there. But the reason why this image came to mind straight away is because after I'd done the climb, I just happened to go into the Ansel Adams gallery. And they had a 20 by 24 print of this, an original print, and it was for sale. And I looked at the price tag and I almost had a heart attack. It was $6,000. And I looked it up on some auction the other day, and I think now it's going for $220,000.
Damn!
But what really struck me about this, like I said, I wasn't a photographer, and I was just blown away with the quality of the print. It was almost like the light was emanating from the print. It really came to life. And funny enough, I did what every other person does. I had the first camera I had was an old Russian Zenit camera. So of course, the first thing I do is go out and buy some black and white film and think, well, yeah, I can, no problem. I can reproduce that, you know, and just dismal failure. But that's why this resonates with me. I mean, it's a brilliant photograph, but it was the first times that I'd been exposed to really intentional, good photography. I just wish I'd had the money to buy the print.
That is a beautiful photo, though, isn't it? Stunning photo.
It is, yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty popular view, but you've got to realise that when he took this...
it wasn't popular, probably, when he took it.
No, and, you know, a lot of his photographs... and this kind of relates back to the contests again that I was saying earlier. You know, his photographs, they helped preserve a lot of these lands, you know.
Oh, and, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the John Muir Trail and all that sort of thing came out of the work that he did. And I mean, you know, when you look at some of his other stuff like Grand Teton and the Snake River, and those sort of, they are totally iconic. And I must admit, I think I might have said this before, but when I'm working with people and I say, you know, if you talk to somebody about music, who's your favourite band, they'll immediately tell you who, whether they're a musician or not. But you say to a photographer, so who are your influences? Who are you inspired by? Very often they struggle because they don't read books and look at stuff and soak it up. And I think it's a great pity because you can get so much pleasure out of looking at what's out there, not just Ansel Adams. Galen Roll, for example, shooting in the same neck of the woods in the 70s for National Geographic. Some stunning photography to be seen.
Yeah. And it's a shame, you know, because a lot of those photographers now... have been kind of forgotten. Because a lot of the photographers I used to follow, and I still do to some degree, they were all large format photographers because that's what I shot. And it's funny, if you look at their photographs now, they just don't have the same amount of impact because back then it was pretty much straight out of camera, you know. So but if you compare them to what people are producing now with this overly dramatic light and, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of taken away from them. And I know that some of those photographers decided to just not do it anymore because they just couldn't keep up with digital photography in the times, you know. Anyway, that's my...
Well done, mate. Good choice.
Came to me.
Yeah, I love that. Right, so James, what have you got for us, mate?
Right, okay, so... When I first heard the brief, and I said this to you a second ago, Adam, what is the image which instantly comes to my mind? It's not a landscape shot. It's one of the most powerful shots that's probably been taken. And it depicts the cruelties of war. Can you see that? So just, yes. Can you see that?
Yeah.
I just grabbed that from the website. And it's quite an iconic, famous shot, and it's the Vietnamese War, 1972, and it's the results of, you see this little girl here in the centre, her clothes just being burned off from the effects of napalm. And for me, this is everything, really, when it comes to a memorable photograph, the emotion, the devastation. It's such, I don't know, for me, it had such an impact on me when I first saw this image. I don't know anything about the photographer, nothing whatsoever. It's purely the imagery. I know you've all taken a bit to talk about each photograph. I don't have much to say about this photograph, but what's in front of you, really? And that's
The little girl, actually, she lives in Canada.
Oh, really?
Canada. Yeah, they've done stories on her since
Kim,
then.
Kim Fook.
Book, yeah. I believe she lives in Canada, yeah.
Incredible shot, isn't it? Because it so graphically depicts the horrors of that war and that time.
I don't know if you guys have seen the latest images from Syria of all the dead children. They're pretty disturbing as well.
The one I instantly think of is the one that rolled up on the beach. The dead boy, was it? The boy rolled up on the beach.
Well, they showed some on the news the other day. It was really disturbing. Children, I mean, there's dozens of them just lying there, killed by gas. That's happening now. But it's pretty graphic, but it's really, I mean, it's kind of like this. I think one day they'll probably become really iconic photographs, you know.
Yeah.
And those are the images that should be being shown every day instead of Meghan and Harry.
Well, they should be instead of Meghan and Harry whining about, you know. Yeah. I mean, really.
And I tell you what's contrasting. You see I'm assuming they are American soldiers. The soldiers, no, they're probably not. They may be Viet Cong, actually. The soldiers in the background just casually walking as opposed to the children that are running for their lives.
Well, it's always the innocents, isn't it? Who are the...
Yeah, exactly. So that's it. I'm going to stop sharing.
Powerful. Very powerful, very graphic. Mm. So mine, and I've got two, and they're nothing like that. They're just iconic for different reasons. I did have a third, and I decided not to show it because I thought I'd just stick with two. My third one was going to be the Beatles, the Abbey Road cover, because hugely influential in pop culture, but... Instead of that, I've gone for these two, and one's more iconic than others, I think. So this is the first one here. So this is the first one. This is Muhammad Ali knocking out Sonny Liston. I don't know when it was. Probably early 70s.
72, 71.
Something like that. And it's just, I think this might have been featured in a program I was watching. Mally put us onto it, actually. He put me onto his program that's on Netflix called Magnum Photographers. And there's this guy, and the first one is actually this guy who followed Muhammad Ali around and just basically got into his inner circle and just took lots of pictures. And I think this guy's called Neil Lather. And it might be him, I'm not 100% sure. But the reason I like this photo is because it's just, I remember Muhammad Ali when I was younger, a lot younger, as sort of like an aging sort of journeyman boxer who's, you know, I think Parkinson's disease was starting to affect him, but he was still trying to fight in the sort of late 80s, early 80s. But this was him absolutely in his prime, and you see those clips of him and his arrogance and his sort of, and that shot is just, you know, that sums him up in one. And I think it's one of the best sports shots ever taken, personally.
I agree. I totally agree.
I mean, I can remember back in the 70s, you know, we all tuned in. We watched the Thriller in Manila and the Rumble in the Jungle, and people who had no interest in boxing, Muhammad Ali's fighting. And, you know, you gathered around your black and white telly and tuned in to watch it.
He was one of the greatest, wasn't he? He really was. And the other image, hopefully it will show up here, and I'm not sure how iconic this one is, to be honest with you, but this is a street photography shot from someone called Fan Ho. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of Fan Ho, but you were saying earlier, Dave, like literally a couple of minutes ago, about it being sad that people don't really know photographers. And when it comes to landscape, I have to hold my hands up and admit that I don't really know that many sort of, you know, obviously everyone's heard of Ansel Adams, but I don't really know that many. But Fan Ho for me is kind of my inspiration behind street photography. If I could take, that's the type of image I want to take when I go out and take street photography. Now, it's changed a little bit because of this Joshua K. Jackson guy, who I'm like really loving his stuff at the moment. But that type of very small person, very big vista, almost a landscape shot within a street shot. And that's the sort of thing that I love. And I think this is a brilliant shot. And for me, I don't know whether it is an iconic shot or not, but I feel like it is.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about it is it's not super crispy sharp like modern digital photography often is.
No.
It's got that lovely, where it doesn't have tonal warmth, the sort of softness of the edges gives it a warmth, because it's obviously a tropical scene.
Yeah. But weirdly enough,
so it's crisp.
Weirdly enough as well, talking about Ansel Adams and the manipulation that he did, Fan Ho apparently was a real master manipulator. He would put shadows in where they weren't and all sorts in the Lightroom, you know. So he was another one who really heavily manipulated his images. But a lot of his images like this, they're very small people in very big vistas, sort of locales, and for street, I love that. So
it's just the position of the character, isn't it? It's right banging in the middle where the light is.
Yeah.
It clearly stands out.
Good choice, Gary.
Thank you.
I prefer the Muhammad Ali photo, but yeah.
That's all right. I love the Muhammad Ali one as well. Yeah. So that's basically, I think, it for... Now, this is going to be interesting, right? Because that's it for this week, everybody. I really hope you've enjoyed it, but we're not going anywhere. We're going to now talk for another hour or so. But we're going to... But we're going to put that out considerably later. So... I want to say a big thanks to Adam for coming on, and we really appreciate it. And
thank
for
you.
Now, we're going to fake a goodbye. So, goodbye.
See you in part two.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Do I have to change my shirt now, then?